We introduced spinner variables, and then you got to see a brief refresher this morning. So again, the idea is they're kind of square roots of massless momenta, and the spinner products are effectively square roots of the Lorentz invariants. So we map the momentum to the dot product of the momentum with the Pauli, the four-vector Pauli matrices. And we can write that in the two-component notation for massless particles. Then we can factor that matrix into an outer product of two complex two-vectors. And those two vectors we tie together with epsilon symbols. And that we define as the spinner product. And of course, there's a conjugate product. And they are square roots of the Lorentz inner product precisely in the sense that they're the product of the two kinds is the Lorentz inner product. And those of you who were actually awake this morning, how many people were awake this morning? No, during the first lecture. So how many of you noticed that a warning I gave yesterday was actually fulfilled in this? Good. So in fact, Song used exactly the opposite convention for the sign of the bracket product, and it's just the way the literature is, and I don't think either side is ever going to convert because there's too much literature that they're used to using that goes the same way. And for real momenta, then we saw that lambda tilde is actually related to the lambda spinners by a complex conjugation. And again, as I didn't have time to tell you yesterday, but you saw it this morning, so this is already a review, that if we redefine the spinners by, and let's for the moment think about real momenta, we redefine the spinners by multiplying by some complex number, then the momentum will be left will be changed by a factor of the this absolute value squared of this number. So it'll be left invariant so long as this tau is a pure phase. And of course, we can multiply each momentum by an independent phase. You also saw again this morning that that phase corresponds to a helicity phase if we're looking at little group transformations. So going back to our Bra and Ket notation, if we do a rotation around the axis, then the lambda spinners will transform by e to the minus I theta over 2, and the bracket spinners by plus e to the plus I theta over 2. So we can identify these essentially as having helicity minus 1/2, and these as helicity plus 1/2. Again, I want to emphasize that these are spinorial objects, but they are not necessarily fermionic objects. These variables are completely bosonic. So we can define a helicity operator. So we can do that for each of the legs to be minus 1/2 times the count of the, essentially the number of lambdas in the expression, and the number minus the number of lambda I, and then the overall helicity operator we can just define as the sum over all the external particles of the individual operators. So one of the things that this tells us is that if we have some expression, we imagine we're doing some complicated analytic expression, that it has to be homogeneous. It's going to be a well-defined expression. Yes?
Sorry, I wondered if you thought the second line would be with an angle bracket. Am I misunderstanding something?
This one here? No, this is these two spinners are of opposite helicity, right? So the lambda and lambda tilde of opposite helicity. The lambdas are all of the same helicity.
I see. I thought because you flipped the direction of like
one. No, I'm being a little bit sneaky here because I want you to think of these two things together. Remember the Gordon identity, that the equivalent of this statement over here was the statement that I can write ki as 1/2 I mu I with an angle and a bracket on the right, right? So I was just trying to keep that consistent. I mean, I could have written it the other way as well. So if you're computing some analytic expression, then and you want that expression to be well defined, then it has to transform homogeneously under little group transformations, and that means that when you're counting the number of appearances of an angle bracket minus a square bracket for any given external leg, that difference has to be the same. So, for example, an expression that has the form, let's say, 3k4 plus 3, 5, let's say 5, what do I want to write here? 5, 6, 6, k prime 4, and then let's say divided by s 3, 4. This is an expression that makes sense because these two terms, for example, under 3 and under 4, they have a non-vanishing phase weight, as sometimes people call it, or helicity weight. Under the phase transformations of 5, these two cancel each other, so they have no phase behavior at all, likewise for 6. So this is a sensible expression, whereas if you do a calculation and you end up, for example, with something like 6 over here, this you should know right away is not a sensible expression because it doesn't behave. The different terms behave in a different way when you make one of these phase rotations, and that's not a sensible expression. So that's one way of doing checks on your. You can use this to help you do checks on your calculations. So again, as Song mentioned this morning, there's really nothing in the constructions that we did yesterday and that we reviewed this morning that depends on this condition over here. So we can imagine relaxing it. Of course, when that happens, that means that this momentum is no longer going to be a real momentum. So this is not what's going to happen when you're actually looking at some physical process. But in intermediate stages or for formal purposes, it's certainly something that we want to keep in mind. And when you do that, then lambda and lambda tilde, it's sort of like z and z bar in complex analysis, that we now free them to be independent. We can think of them as being independent. Instead of being z and z bar, they just become z1 and z2. They're just independent variables. OK, so now we've done a lot of background work and defined some useful objects. Let's start to calculate something. And we're going to start by calculating gluon amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory. And as people probably know, something you learned in your basic field theory courses, the gluons have two physical polarizations. And one of the many things to have come out of this sort of area of research is the observation that really the sensible way of thinking about these is in terms of a helicity basis. It's something that was, as amazing as it may sound, was not obvious 25 years ago. And in fact, we're going to start by computing the three-point amplitude, which is about the simplest object that you can imagine. And in fact, it's the building block out of which you can build all other amplitudes, so all other tree amplitudes and even all other loop amplitudes in perturbation theory. Not saying it's necessarily trivial or an afternoon's work to do that, but once you have this ingredient in hand, everything else can be derived from it. So if we look at the kinematics for three particles, then we have three on-shell particles, and we can use momentum conservation. And so we find that k1.k2 vanishes, and we're going to, of course, if we start with k1 squared, we'll find that k2.k3 vanish. So in fact, all the invariants vanish. And if we think back to our original form of the spinor products, that we might believe that that says that all the spinor products vanish. So that would mean that, for example, all the free angle products vanish, and all the bracket products vanish. Incidentally, just from seeing this part of the equation, then because of this phase wave consideration I just mentioned, you know that this equation is only sensible if there's an equal to zero at the end of it. So if this were the case, these are the only things that we can really use to the basic invariants that we can use to build up the three-point amplitude, then we would conclude that the three-point amplitude for real momenta vanishes. Or perhaps you might imagine it's ill-defined. And this statement is true, because you cannot have an on-shell gluon splitting into two on-shell gluons, two collinear on-shell gluons. But while it's a true statement, it's also not very useful as a building block, because we do know that all the higher point amplitudes and loop corrections don't vanish. If this were actually the final answer, then we would just say it's a free field theory and we'd go home. So of course, you already know the resolution of this issue, because this conclusion depended on our taking the momenta to be real. And what we want to do is to relax the spinners to be no longer subject to the complex conjugation condition that forces the momenta to be real. And when we do this, then in turn, we have the fact that an invariant vanishes. Certainly, it forces one of the spinor products over there to vanish. So we will find that, for example, the angle product vanishes, or we might find that the bracket product vanishes. But we do not need, but not necessarily both. So, yes?
Why can't we have a mix of some angle products and some square products?
It's a good question, and I'll leave that as an exercise for all of you, because it's actually pretty straightforward. In fact, I haven't even said that that's what I'm going to take yet, right? I mean, so far I've just said for one given momentum, we can have one or the other. But it's a good question, and I'm not going to go through it myself. So actually, let me write the exercise on the next board. Or in a few minutes when we get to... So let's start by satisfying the on-shell conditions by taking all the bracket products to vanish. And all right, I'll write the exercise now. Exercise show that the only two options are all brackets equals 0 or all angle equals 0. Okay, so we now have three invariants to play with. We can play with angle 1, 2, angle 2, 3, and angle 3, 1. We need to have something that's homogeneous in these three. So let's write an ansatz for A3. A3 is going to equal some constant times each of the angle products raised to its own power. Well, we already know what these powers are, because when we do use the helicity operator, then of course, in this expression, it's going to pick up the it's going to pick up the factors of E12, E23, and E31. But we know that the amplitude has to be given by some helicity state. We're working in a helicity basis for the amplitudes. So we can write down three equations. The helicity of leg 1 is equal to minus 1 half of E12 plus E31. Helicity of leg 2 is minus 1 half E23 plus E12. And the helicity of leg 3 is minus 1 half E31 plus E23. So it's probably late enough in the day we can do a little bit of algebra. And even though these equations are trivial and all of you can solve them in your head, I will still write down the solutions explicitly. So E12 is H3 minus H1 minus H2, and then there are similar forms cyclically rotated for the remaining exponents. So let's imagine that we're looking at one of the helicity amplitudes. So there's two helicities, and there's three particles, so we have eight total. You already might suspect that there's going to be some symmetries between them, but let's just take this one step at a time. So let's look at the minus minus plus helicity. So we're looking at 1 minus, 2 minus, 3 plus. Well, we can just use these equations. We find that E12 is 3, and E23 and E31 are both minus 1. So that means that our amplitude has the form of a constant times the angle product 1, 2 cubed divided by the angle product 2, 3 and the angle product 3, 1. Does that look familiar to anyone? How many people is it familiar? Oh, some people were not awake this morning. It's, of course, exactly the formula that Sung wrote down, but specialized to the case n equals 3. And there's also the fact that I've canceled a 1, 2, an angle 1, 2 between the numerator and the denominator. The formula he wrote down had a 1, 4, but it canceled against one of the cyclic terms in the denominator. Now, the spinners have an energy dimension of 1 half. Well, technically, I guess for complex momenta, you could make them have different dimensions, but that would be kind of perverse. So the spinner products have a dimension of an energy. That makes sense. They're the square roots of Lorentz product. So this thing has the dimension, energy dimension of 1. And that's good. An endpoint amplitude should have the dimension of 4 minus n. So this thing has dimension energy. That's correct for a 3-point amplitude, so long as the constant is dimensionless. And we'll come back to the constant a little bit later. Well, that was good. Let's try one more. So let's suppose we want to try now the helicity with 1 plus, 2 plus, and 3 minus. Well, everything is just conjugated. So if we were to just use those equations, then we would find that E12 is minus 3 and E23 and E31 are equal to 1. So if we wrote this down, then we would find 2, 3, 3, 1 divided by 1, 2 cubed times a constant. And this is bad. It's bad for a lot of different reasons, but one thing that's pretty obvious is that the constant here would have to be dimensionful for this to make any sense, and there's no dimensionful constant in the pure Yang-Mills theory. The amplitude is also pathological in another way, that if you try and take the limit of real momenta, you go back to the situation where, let's say, lambda tilde is equal to, you approach a configuration where lambda tilde is equal to lambda star, then this thing won't vanish. It'll blow up. So that also seems a little bit pathological. So what should we do here? Well, instead of using the configuration where all the bracket products vanish, instead we can go to the configuration where instead the angle products vanish. And then going through kind of the same argumentation here, it's pretty clear that if we do parity conjugation, we're essentially replacing an angle product with a bracket product. And so we're just going to get this formula. But instead of the MHV formula for n equals 3, we're going to get the MHV bar formula for n equals 3. And there's no guarantee at this point that the constants are the same. And so here we're going to find that this amplitude is equal to constant. I'm writing it just as constant, but it could conceivably be different. In fact, it turns out to be to differ by a minus sign. So this is just the MHV bar formula. Well, actually, we can see that we have also covered the cyclic permutations because these equations are cyclically symmetric. So for example, if we had 2 minus 3 minus, we'd simply get a 2, 3, angle 2, 3 cubed divided by angle 1, 2, angle 3, 1, and so on. And that's, of course, consistent with the cyclic symmetry that we expect of these objects. Yes?
So how do we know in general which set of brackets to take normally?
Well, we're essentially working that out. What we're discovering by sort of working this out on general grounds is that you're going to associate the MHV with the non-vanishing angle brackets and the MHV bar with the non-vanishing square brackets. The other answer to that will be essentially you can do this from the Feynman rules, and then you'll discover that if you insist on this solution, that amplitude will simply vanish. But that, again, is I'm going to leave as an exercise at the end of the lecture.
Coming back to this question, does it follow from momentum conservation that one of them is zero and the other becomes zero?
Yeah, as I said, it's a straightforward exercise, which is why I'm leaving it as an exercise. So, yeah. Okay, now we've taken the other choice, and once you're through with your little exercise there, you'll know that I've exhausted there's no third configuration I have to consider.
Is it generally true that if you reverse all the helices, then the angle becomes the square bracket?
Well, so the parity transformation is essentially taking exchanging negative and positive helicities, and what it's actually going to do is replace an ij. The spinner conjugation operation essentially is going to be replacing an ij with a ji. So an angle ji is going to be replaced by a bracket. Angle ij will be replaced by bracket ji. Okay, so we have 6 out of the 8 helicity amplitudes covered. And there's 2 more. So let's think about the minus, minus, minus configuration. Well, in that case, it's pretty clear that all these exponents would be the same. And so then we would find that the amplitude would want to be just the simple product of the angle products. And this thing is also bad. It's not quite as bad as our bad guess for the MHV bar amplitude, because at least it's not pathological. In fact, as we go to real momenta, it vanishes more strongly. But the problem is that the constant, again, has to be dimensionful. So if we're just working in pure Yang-Mills, there is no such constant. But if you imagine adding some higher dimension operator, for example, something like a G cubed operator, then there's certainly going to be dimensionful constants. And in fact, you may be able to get a non-vanishing amplitude. Okay. So now the next thing we want to ask is, what is this constant? So if we look here at this amplitude, and let's imagine exchanging legs 1 and 2. Well, the denominator is going to stay the same. I mean, both of these two spinner products both flip form. We get 1, 3, 3, 2. If we then reverse this into the original form and reverse this, then we have 2 minus signs, so nothing happens. But this thing changes by a sign. So if this is supposed to be an amplitude of gluons, then clearly there's a problem here, because this thing is not Bose symmetric. And in fact, if we had no other constant to take care of this problem, if we couldn't do something with a constant to solve this problem of of anti-symmetry, then the only answer would be zero. And if you think about what happens in QED, so in a U1 gauge theory, there is no three photon amplitude, at least, in fact, that's a statement which is true to all orders because of Fourier's theorem. But in a Yang-Mills theory, of course, we have the constant can be proportional to, in this case, FA1, A2, A3. So the overall amplitude can be Bose-symmetric again. So the object that we've been computing here is exactly the pure kinematic factor. It's the color-ordered amplitude. And of course, in Song's lecture yesterday, you understood how to go back and forth between the full amplitude and the color-ordered subamplitude. And it's exactly the same thing for the three-point amplitude. Now, it can be proportional. Of course, there's one remaining, in some sense, rescaling opportunity. And that additional rescaling opportunity is precisely the coupling. So remember that everything else is going to be built out of this. So the only place that we get to say how strong is this interaction is over here. It's in our. This is where we inject the coupling, the gauge coupling. So one other thing you've noticed here is that I haven't mentioned Lagrangian. And in fact, in principle, if we started this way, and now as the week goes on, we'll see how to build up all other amplitudes, first tree amplitudes, and then loop amplitudes, just from this three-point tree. So in fact, we have a means of computing everything in the theory just based on the constraints of Lorentz invariance and Bose symmetry without ever referring to a Lagrangian. Now, one way we can actually recognize this thing as what you would conventionally call the coupling in the Lagrangian is to compute it from the Lagrangian as well and see that these two formula are actually the same. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave that as an exercise. So compute A3 from the Feynman three-point vertex. You've already seen the one missing ingredient that I haven't given you in my lectures that you need to do that. Those are a spinorial representation of the polarization vectors. Because it's always nice to see something twice, then let me write them down for you again. So again, we're going to introduce a reference vector. Usually it's chosen to be real, but there's no need. It could be complex, as was essentially implicitly done this morning. And it should be null. That means that you can write it as the product of the two spinners in the notation of Song's lecture this morning. Those were the mu and the mu tilde spinners. And we can define the polarization vectors for a given momentum, label J, with this reference momentum. And likewise, there's essentially a conjugate form for the positive helicity. Qj, comma Q. So So just as a reminder, if we do a phase transformation on Q, you can see that we have a bracket in the numerator, a bracket in the denominator. So that is manifestly independent of it. Of course, even though I've mentioned introducing a reference vector, we can introduce independent reference vectors for each of the external legs. And for some purposes, that's a useful thing to do. If we look at the transformation properties of under phase rotations of the momentum, then we find that there's a minus 1/2 phase in the numerator, and then there's a plus 1/2 but phase in the denominator. So when we put it in the numerator, it's just another minus 1/2. So this thing indeed has helicity minus 1, and correspondingly, this thing has helicity plus 1. So these polarization vectors are sometimes known as, go under the name of XZC, or even they're called Chinese magic, because they originated in a preprint by Zhang Zhu, Zhang and Chang, who were then at Tsinghua University. And this is in the mid-1980s. Today, interesting papers coming out of China doesn't seem very exotic, but in the mid-1980s was only a few years after the universities had reopened, and it was really like something coming, this amazing thing coming out of the wilderness. So let's see here. There's a couple of other exercises that we can, I will leave you to do. So first of all, so show that these polarization vectors have the correct form. To be polarization vectors for circular polarizations. And then you have the rederivation of the 3-point amplitude from the Feynman vertex. Pick up Peskin and Schroeder or your favorite quantum field theory book. Strip the color indices from the 3-point vertex and then just compute using this representation. And finally, for those of you who want to see, test out your understanding of this derivation, you can derive the 3-point amplitude for two fermions and one gluon. If you're going to do that, you need to think carefully about what exactly the helicities are supposed to be. Okay. So, any questions up to this point? Okay. Good. So the next thing we want to do is to calculate beyond the 3-point amplitude. And before we do that, this is where we're going to make use of factorization as a calculational tool. We need to review a little bit about how factorization works in field theory. And we'll also see some peculiarities of gauge theories. So we know that it's a generic property of amplitudes in quantum field theories. And the way one can phrase it is if we imagine we have two momenta that are approaching, the sum of two momentum is approaching the mass of some intermediate state. So the sum of two momenta is going on shell. Then, assuming all the quantum numbers of that intermediate state cooperate with the quantum numbers that are associated with particles 1 and 2, then if we look at some amplitude that, let's say, involves the scattering of 1 plus 2 into some final state that involves n particles, we know that it's going to, as we approach that on-shell configuration, then we're going to go to a sum over all the intermediate states that make up x, and we'll have a factorization into a left amplitude where the initial state is essentially producing, I don't know how I should denote the intermediate states here, but put it as a little x. And then there's going to be a pole, a propagator. And then there's going to be an amplitude for the decay of that object into the final state. So it's the heuristic picture that if you're getting very close to the on-shell limit, then the two things can form this on-shell state. It can propagate for some amount of time and then eventually decay. And the two amplitudes essentially decouple from each other. More generally, we can imagine that the momentum squared, I should have really used k here. All right. More generally, as the sum of some collection of more than two momenta approaches, again, some on-shell pole, then if we have some amplitude for this endpoint process, n r point process, n particles scattering into r minus n plus 1, then this again will factorize into a left amplitude producing the intermediate state, which then propagates and eventually decays. Now, this is, strictly speaking, not quite true in gauge theories. So first of all, it's not actually true for the two-point function. Again, we're thinking about real momenta. You can see that there's going to be a problem over here in the two-point case, or the three-point, where the amplitude on the left-hand side is a three-point amplitude, because near the pole we have something that's approaching zero and something that's approaching zero in the denominator, so we have kind of a zero over zero problem. So that's one kind of caveat that one has to be careful about. And the other thing is that this statement turns out to be not true beyond tree level in perturbation theory, basically because of soft physics and infrared divergences. But at tree level, once we're looking at three or more legs on the left-hand side and three or more legs on the right-hand side, everything really goes through straightforwardly. And we can do this diagrammatically if we imagine we have some amplitude here. And this picture here is supposed to represent conceptually the sum of all Feynman diagrams. It's a tree-level amplitude. Of course, we don't necessarily want to compute the Feynman diagrams, but if you want to think of it, you can think of it that way as the sum, the tree-level amplitude, the sum of all Feynman diagrams. And if we now look in the limit that the sum of these three momenta is going on shell, well, on shell here means that the square goes to zero because we're in a massless theory. We also want to put in the condition that no two-particle invariant is going to zero. That essentially means that the energy of one of these momenta has to be opposite to the other two. So in that limit, we will get a factorization and that sum over little x there is basically the sum over all the states that have the given mass. In this case, it's just the two helicities of the gluon. And we have the propagator. I'm pretty much going to be uniformly suppressing any Feynman I epsilons for those of you who are purists and like to have them written out in your formulas. And then we have all the remaining legs tied into another amplitude. So I can label this leg X if I so feel inclined. And just as in Sung Hae's lectures, we're going to use the convention that all momenta are outgoing. So the momentum here is actually directed outward from the amplitude, so into the propagator, and likewise over here. Remember that when you're flipping the sign of the momentum, you're also flipping the helicity. So that's why helicity conservation here means that I have to sum a plus with a minus and a minus with a plus. It's not maybe the most intuitive thing, but it's a question of following through on your conventions. So this is a four-point amplitude, and then this will be the amplitude for the remaining legs. It'll be an n minus two-point amplitude. So one exercise actually you're already equipped to do with the Park-Taylor formula from this morning is to see so this is, in this case, called a three-particle pole, or in general, a multi-particle pole. So show why there are no multi-particle poles, that is, with n greater than 2 in MHV or MHV bar amplitudes. I don't mean you can, of course, see that manifestly from the Park-Taylor formula, so you know it's true, but now try to argue it just on general grounds without actual recourse to the formula itself. I'll leave the discussion of the detailed discussion of what happens in the three-point case to later in the week. But if we think about our three-point amplitude again, then we can see that each of these, remember, is still going to go to zero if we go back to real momenta. And this is scaling in some sense as E cubed, and each of these is E. So this thing will be scaling overall as some energy. It'll be scaling as a spinner product. The pole over here, if it were a two-particle invariant, is an SAB. It's in some sense the square of a spinner product. So in the case where we have a three-point amplitude, so we have just two external legs, roughly speaking, that factorization is going to go, and I'm writing it a little bit schematically here, one can work it out more precisely, it's going to go as the spinner product divided by a spinner product squared. And so we might expect that the combination of these two things actually goes as a 1 over spinner product. And if for certain helicities this is actually correct, there's additional factors that measure, in some sense, the momentum fraction of the two legs that are becoming collinear here. In a massless theory, a two-particle invariant going to zero means that the two momenta are becoming proportional to each other, or as we say, collinear. And then you can ask what fraction of the sum of the momentum is each one of them carrying. So in the special case of gauge theories, instead of having this full pole singularity, it's actually softened the 0 over 0 ambiguity that's coming from the numerator being 0 and the denominator being 0 gets softened to the square root, in some sense, the square root of the invariant as the singularity. However, the one thing that will be important for us as we go on, if instead of real momenta, we're actually working with complex momenta, then what I've kind of written here as the square of a spinner product, or maybe I should have written as the absolute value of a spinner product squared, is really just two different spinner products. And the numerator, depending on the amplitude, is going to go as one or the other. So now we're actually going to, the angle products will cancel. And then as we take the limit, the bracket product will vanish in kind of a standard way. So when we're doing complex momenta, there's nothing special that we have to worry about. In this case, we just go through and the factorization works through normally. Okay, so with that in hand, we're now ready to get started. Go partway through and then probably not abuse either your patience or the monitor's patience here by running too far over. We're going to look at constructing Altri amplitudes now. And we have all the ingredients that we need to derive the formula that we're going to use. Namely, we have our basic interaction, which is just the three-point amplitude. And we have, we've reviewed our understanding of factorization. And now we're going to go and turn it into a computational tool. So we want to write down a set of so-called on-shell recursion relations that are also known after the names of the people who wrote them down, Ruth Brito, Freddie Cachazzo, who's actually here at the perimeter, although I gather he's actually away this week. Right? Yes. And I do believe he was also away last week. Bo Feng, and One guess who the W stands for?
Whitten.
Yes, Ed Whitten. So what we're going to do is we're going to start deforming. The first thing we're going to do is start deforming the amplitude. So we imagine we have some amplitude, which is a function of all the different spinners. Let's say it's some n-point amplitude, so j goes from 1 to n. And we also have a set of helicity labels. And what we want to do is to define a shift operation. So we're going to introduce a complex parameter z, generic complex variables are always called z, and if not z, then w. So this operation is going to do the following thing. We're going to shift. We're going to pick out two legs, J and L, and we're going to label this operation. Let me label it J and L. And someone here should stay alert in case I accidentally switch J and L, which happens. So we're going to shift the bracket spinners by something that's proportional to the L bracket spinner. So that's a shift of the lambda tilde spinners. And then at the same time, we're going to do a shift of the L angle spinner by something that's, in some sense, a compensating shift proportional to the J angle spinner. Again, we're thinking now really of all of these spinners as independent, the lambdas being independent from the lambda tildes. So this is not necessarily the complex conjugate of that guy, and this guy is not necessarily the complex conjugate of that guy. But I am correlating the shifts in this way. So the motivation here, at least for doing it in this precise form, is we can now look at the momenta, which at the end of the day, that's what the amplitude is going to depend on. It's going to depend on, if we think about the amplitude squared, it's going to depend on some invariant. So this shifts it to be a function of z, which is of course just the original momentum. And then because we've shifted the bracket spinner, remember the 1/2 from the Gordon identity, then we can write it in this form over here. And similarly, the L external momentum also becomes a function of z, and it gets shifted in precisely the opposite direction. But it gets shifted very cleverly by the same vector. So because J and L are not the same, this is a complex vector, but we're all happy and comfortable with that right now. And the remaining legs are unchanged. So they're not functions of z, they're just whatever they used to be. So this has deformed our amplitude into some function of z, of this parameter, complex parameter z. No, I don't think it wants to stay.
Sometimes you put another brush on it and hold it down.
I'm sorry?
Put another brush on it and hold it down.
Oh, never mind. I think people can see the essential parts there. Okay, so what two other things we can notice? So there's only two momenta that are changed, and they're changed exactly in compensating ways. So that means that the sum of these two momenta, kj plus kl, goes to kj, which is a function of z, plus kl, which is now a function of z. And that thing is exactly the same as what we started with. So in particular, the shift leaves momentum conservation untouched. The sum of all the ki is unchanged. The other thing we can observe is that if we look at the square of kj, and of course we're starting with some gluon amplitude, so all these, all the external momenta are massless. That's of course implicit in writing them in terms of the a single pair of spinners for each one. So this thing is going to be shifted to a z-dependent function. Of course, we have, if we now just expand out that square, then we're going to find that we have the, let me write it in this form for a minute. And then there's z squared over 4 of, so we have three terms. Well, this term is easy because it started out 0 and it's just a constant, so it stays 0. So does anyone have any opinion about the middle term? Well, kj itself is, of course, massless, so I can factor it into a lambda and lambda tilde spinner. That means I can write this term as jj times angle jj times bracket jl. And of course, the spinner product is anti-symmetric, so this term vanishes. OK, what about the last term? Does anyone have an opinion on the last term? Who said that? Yeah, that's correct, but why? The Fierce identity, yes, exactly right. So here there's actually two ways to play that game, but when I Fierce this around, then I'm going to get 2 times jj times ll. Take your pick, both of these vanish. So again, this thing is going to vanish. So the momentum, the shifted momentum still is on shell. So we have an amplitude that momentum conservation, and all the legs are on shell, just that some of the two of the legs have now been, or now have complex momenta. But at tree level, there's nothing really very, very difficult about that. So the other thing we're going to do is to assume, and we'll come back to justify that assumption, that as z goes to infinity, that the amplitude actually vanishes. In the greater scheme of things, it turns out that that's not completely essential, but for the original form and the basic form of the BCFW recursion, one does need to make this assumption, and we'll come back to justify it later. It's something that, again, with the Park-Taylor formula, so so test this assumption. On the Park-Taylor formula, and choose J and L to be some, to not be equal to negative helicity legs. Just choose them to be two positive helicity legs, and test out this assumption. So the next thing we want to do is to consider a contour integral. And we're going to take it on around infinity. So on a circle enclosing infinity. Yes.
Do we also deform the corresponding polarization vectors?
So the amplitude, at the end of the day, we've already seen some formulas. So when I wrote down, when we derived the formula for the three-point amplitude, it's not a function of polarization vectors. It's a function of the spinners.
Sure.
When you saw the Park-Taylor formula, it's not a function of polarization vectors. It's a function of the spinners. Right? So the polarization vectors are how you write it if you're starting with the Feynman vertex, but it's not the final functional form of the amplitude. I want you to think here about the final functional form of the amplitude. It's just a function of lambdas and lambda tildes in the helicity labels. You've done the calculation and the polarization vectors, you've used spinner helicity, you've used some other representation, you've come to a final expression in terms of the spinner variable. So that's a natural statement if you're thinking in projective coordinates, but if you want a more pedestrian way of thinking about it, we just draw a circle and we keep making that circle bigger and bigger. So that we're going to run at a circle a circle at infinity. So and the contour integral that we're going to consider is one where we've essentially put in an extra whole, so we're going to look at this deformed amplitude divided by z. So we actually know the value of this integral. We're not really interested in the integral per se. We're interested in what the integral can tell us. So the integral is going to vanish because we already have a dz over z, and we're assuming that this thing is falling off. Now, you can think that at tree level, everything is a rational function. It's not just a function of lambdas and lambda tildes. It's a rational function of lambdas and lambda tildes. We've done a linear shift on some of these spinners, and so that's just changing. We have a rational function of z, and so if this thing is going to go as, if a is going to go to 0, it has to go to 0 at least as 1 over z. So this thing, in fact, is going to go as 1 over z squared, and that means that if you take some circle at infinity, then that integral, as the circle gets larger, the value of the integral gets smaller, so the integral vanishes. So that's one way of evaluating the integral. And the other way is to compute the integral by residues. So, well, one pole should be obvious. There's a pole at z equals 0. And the residue, which I've taken into account the prefactor at 0, is in fact is just a of 0. So it's our original amplitude. So that's already very promising because it says that we have our original amplitude plus a whole bunch of other stuff is equal to 0. So we have an equation. We can already see that we're going to have an equation that we can solve for our amplitude of interest. It's not guaranteed yet that the stuff, the remaining stuff, is stuff that we can calculate directly, but patience. So we have the beginnings of a formula. We sum over all the other poles. A, so here these poles are understood to be not at 0 of the residue at these poles of our integrand, which is a of z over z. And this is where factorization comes in. Because where are the poles in the amplitude? So the poles in the amplitude correspond to factorization. In fact, I should have mentioned this earlier, not only is this the generic pattern for the way that amplitudes in a quantum field theory behave, in fact, in a unitary quantum field theory, these are the only poles that the amplitudes will have. They won't have other random poles at strange places in momentum invariance. So we can enumerate all of these poles by enumerating factorization channels. And I think I will actually stop here, and we will continue the derivation and do some sample calculations tomorrow. Any questions at this point? Okay. Yes.
What's the reference for the integral being zero again? You said that the amplitude will
The hard edge people in the audience would say it's by assumption, but in fact, I've made an assumption, which we'll come back to justify tomorrow, that the amplitude should vanish as z goes to infinity. And basically, at tree level, it's always going to, at least in Yang-Mills, it's always going to be possible to choose J and L in such a way that this condition is satisfied. So it doesn't actually matter how, well, other than the issues of branch cuts, it doesn't really matter how it goes to zero as long as it does go to zero. But we can argue a little bit further, again, that we have a rational function of z. So the only way it can go to zero is if it has to scale as some power of z because it's a rational function. So it can only go to zero as 1 over z. That means that the integrand is going to be 1 over z squared or smaller. And if you take some circle around, you know, it's some very large circle, and then you just do dz over z is essentially going to turn into d theta, but you're going to still have one additional power of 1 over r, the radius of the circle. So that's just 2 pi divided by r, and as you take r to infinity, the integral is just going to vanish. Yes?
Could you explain the statement that poles are one-to-one correspondence with factorization channels?
Yeah, because that's a reflection of the fact that the full explanation of how the poles in Z are in correspondence with factorization channels, that you'll have to wait till tomorrow. However, the statement that poles in momentum invariance correspond to factorization channels, that's just a general statement about quantum field theory. I mean, in some sense, it's tree-level unitarity of the S matrix demand that you can't have some... you can't have other combinations of momenta or momenta and reference vectors, revealing singularities. They would be called spurious singularities because they would not be physical objects. It would mean that you're somehow able to create some object which is not an intermediate state. It's not an unphysical state in a physical channel. I mean, it would mean your theory is inconsistent, essentially. I think, I mean, if you want a much deeper analysis of that question, then you should look at Weinberg's textbook. I think he has a discussion of that issue.
Is there any physical intuition for Z?
Is there any physical intuition for Z? In a sense, you can think of it as at least the z going to infinity is kind of probing the large momentum behavior in some complex direction of the amplitude. But and you can also think of it as being related to a variable which helps you partial fraction in an amplitude in a useful way. I'm not sure that really qualifies as a physical motivation, but that's really, in some sense, that's the role it's really playing here, even if the derivation today and tomorrow is not quite going to make that clear.
Can you comment something on the purposes of gauge fixing?
Well, we're looking here at on-shell amplitudes, and I think, I don't know if I forget actually if it was suggested as an exercise this morning, but remember that I suggested as an exercise over here to demonstrate that the polarization vectors have of this particular form have the required form, which among other things means that when you change the reference vector, you're just doing a gauge transformation. So because I'm looking at on-shell amplitudes, then you can fix the gauge in any way you like. So in particular, in the language of the spinner helicity formalism, the choice of gauge for the external momenta is precisely the question of the choice of Q. And you're allowed to choose Q in any way you like, as long as it's not collinear with the momentum of the particle involved. And you can choose it, and then you do the calculation. And then once you do that, if you've done the calculation correctly, you'll find out that Q actually drops out. The final answer is independent of Q. It only depends on the spinners that are associated with the external momenta. So in particular, for example, this amplitude is manifestly not a function of Q. It's not a function of this residual gauge degree of freedom. So in other words, one answer is that it's irrelevant. The other answer is you fix a gauge any way you like, and you can use this computation. And in fact, the computation will be the same. It's manifestly gauge invariant computation.
So you don't need to introduce ghosts?
There's no. First of all, at tree level, you don't need to introduce ghosts anyway. Loop level, in the on-shell methods, you do not introduce ghosts. Is not obvious from this discussion of the BCFW recursion relation because it's not talking about loops.
So what are you talking about loops there? You have to
do. I think I will ask you to wait until late tomorrow or Thursday. Actually, maybe I will even ask you to wait till Friday, because the introductory part of the unitarity lectures may not fully answer that question.
Another question, then why don't we take a break and come back in 15 minutes.